Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
J.J. Sandlin, for the appellants, Mr. and Mrs. Manning, and esteemed counsel, I have Martin Carson.
So the parties are ready?
Yes. How much time do we have?
10 minutes per side. And if you are the appellant, you may reserve a certain amount of time for rebuttal. The respondent will take 10 minutes. Are you ready? Please proceed.
Thank you.
There's a clock right here that'll tell you how much
time. Oh, thank you very much. May it please the court, esteemed counsel, and observers, I'm J.J. Sandlin, and this is actually the first time I think I've appeared in person before you, but I...
Welcome, and would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Oh, yes, I would like to reserve the majority of the time for rebuttal.
And precisely how much time would you like to reserve?
How about 6 minutes? Would that work?
6 minutes will be fine. So you're going to talk now for 4 minutes.
Okay.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
You may begin.
All right, thank you. Your Honor, first of all, I owe all of you an apology. I didn't appear, but my documents appeared without oral argument on another case, and I couldn't find the clerk's index, and so I specced it in and referred to specific documents, and you let me know how wrong that was, but then you ruled on the merits anyway, but I apologize for not doing that. Now, today, we have referred to the clerk's index, and what we're here on is a 12B6 motion that was granted up in San Juan County in Friday Harbor, without oral argument, and it's our contention that there are facts either stated in our verified complaint or which could be inferred by the verified complaint that would allow us to at least have an amendment to the verified complaint rather than...
Would we be treating this as a 12B6 motion or a summary judgment motion given the fact that declarations were filed and other materials outside the complaint considered by the trial court?
It should be treated as a 12B6 motion, and the reason for that is that there's been no discovery at all. It was filed, and shortly thereafter, there was a trustee sale, and then a 12B6 motion was filed to dismiss it for failure to state a cause of action for which relief could be granted. And I've looked at the case law, and I briefed it. The exemplary briefing by the appellee, certainly had a lot of cases in it, but really I don't think that there's a lot of cases that really apply. I think Bavand, which is one of your cases, applies, although distinguishing Bavand, in that case the trustee was appointed a day, as I recall, before the appointing entity actually was the assignee of the deed of trust. But in this room, we go all the way back to the beginning. There is a way that whoever might be the holder of the note could be the holder of the note and assert a legitimate deed of trust lien position, but it's not through this pathway. Through this pathway, the defendants are all relying upon an assignment from MERS.
Are they, or could they simply say the note was acquired in 2004 by the Bank of New York and the deed of trust followed the note, and when Bank of America took possession of the note, the deed of trust followed it to Bank of America, and when Residential Credit Solutions took possession of the note, the deed of trust followed the note to Residential Credit Solutions?
I don't think so. First of all, the note, I'm reading between the lines with your question, that you're assuming that this note is an Article 3 unconditional promise of pay, and it most certainly is not.
If it was, what would be wrong with my description?
You're getting closer. I don't think you're there yet because...
What am I missing?
Well, what you're missing is at the very get-go, MERS was claiming that it had the authority to assign the deed of trust. The deed of trust was never assigned. And so, therefore,
why is the deed of trust at all necessary, given the assignment, rather, of the deed of trust at all necessary, given the case law that says that the deed of trust follows the note, and the holder of the note is the entity with authority to enforce the note and the non-judicial remedies available under the deed of trust?
Well, the quick answer is the deed of trust and the note were split. And if they are split and held by different entities, the deed of trust is not a lien on that note.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you for hearing me.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Carson. I'm here on behalf of respondents. I think if the court takes a look at the structure of the trial court's decision on the motion to dismiss, I think it answers several questions about either how this court needs to think about the standard by which to judge this appeal, and secondly, what the real dispositive issues in this case are. And so the trial court's reasoning puts the issue sort of in two buckets. One, you have the claims that would have been waived under the Plein case, the Frizzell case, and RCW 6124-130. Those are his claims the Manning's claims, excuse me.
Do we use the 12B6 standard of review or summary judgment standard of review?
I think there's two answers to this question. I know that sounds a little odd, but the 12B6 standard could be applied to the court's written decision, because in the court's written decision, there is no facial evidence or no indication that the court was relying on the declaration of RCS in support of its holder status of the note. I think that the way that the structure, i.e. that there's waived claims, non-waived claims, and the non-waived claims are barred by the statute of limitations on the one hand and barred by non-compliance under CR9 on the other hand, this court could take that structure of the trial court's opinion and affirm. But if
without considering any of the later filed documents?
That's accurate, Your Honor. But if this court decides that, you know, just on the abundance of caution, there were documents in front of the trial court at the time the decision was rendered. There was the request for judicial notice, which contained the declaration with the promissory note attached, that there's a remedy for that as well, which is that this court.
What does the trial court's order on motion to dismiss say the court considered?
Let me bring that up, Your Honor. The court does say in the decision that it reviewed the motion and the request for judicial notice. It does not specify, obviously, the individuated parts of the request for judicial notice that were considered. If I can get back to my point, the CR 56 standard could be applied if this court, in the abundance of caution, thought that the trial court had considered the declaration of RCS and had considered the note itself. That's not without precedent. I believe that case, the McAfee case that was cited, does exactly that, takes some matters under the CR 56 rubric on appeal, does not remand for additional findings, but rather just considers it. And if
additional documents, I take it any additional documents that were in front of the trial court were submitted by the defendants, not by the plaintiff. Is that correct?
That is precisely right.
So in terms of fairness, I mean, the plaintiff, it doesn't sound like had any advice that it was going to be converted into a motion for summary judgment.
That
as far
may
as the plaintiff could see, the judge was going to treat it as a 12B6 motion.
That may be true, Your Honor. However, there is a question in terms of fairness of whether or not any of those challenges that he might make have been waived, in the sense that the Mannings make specific arguments about the content of the note. They make arguments about its negotiability under Article 3. They make arguments about the evidence that's there. Now,
I see.
So it's as if the appellants would like that evidence in as much as the respondents.
So what you're saying is that the plaintiff asserts in support of its argument evidence submitted by the defendant that wasn't attached to the complaint.
Precisely right, Your Honor. So the let me just continue to go through this. As to the waived claims, I think the waiver doctrine is quite clear. The appellants received notice of the sale. They had actual or constructive notice of the defenses before the sale, and they failed to obtain an order enjoining the sale. Under RCW 6124-130, under the Pline versus Lackey and Frizzell cases, those claims are waived whether or not we look at additional evidence. And so that's the wrongful foreclosure claim, the injunctive relief claim, the declaratory relief claim, slander.
Let me ask you a question. Since waiver is a discretionary equitable doctrine, and the state Supreme Court has said that waiver isn't required by the statute, but focuses on the word may, and the claims may be waived, how can you hold under 12b-6 motion that claims are waived as a matter of law? Don't you need some facts to exercise discretion?
Well, the facts as pled in the complaint lead to even assuming they're all true. That gets you to these elements, irrespective of any factual inquiry that might occur later on. The complaint was brought, and let me get my timeline, because the timeline is important here, because at the time that the complaint was brought, the foreclosure had not completed.
The trustee's sale occurred the day after the complaint was filed.
I believe that's accurate.
Yeah, that's what the pleadings reflect.
Mm-hmm. And the statute requires that the borrowers must, A, notify the trustee within 5 days of their intent to enjoin the sale, and they must enjoin the sale. They must try to enjoin the sale in order to preserve these non-damages claims, these equitable relief claims and these declaratory relief claims. It wasn't error for the court below to find that. Secondarily, as to the non-waived claims, the court does specify that at least two of the claims, the CPA claim and the fraud claim, might be non-waived. The CPA claim is clearly barred by the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is 4 years. The loan and MERS's role with respect to the deed of trust have been known by the borrowers for many, many years.
When are the Mannings first damaged? When are the Mannings first damaged? Damages are an element of the CPA claim.
The respondent contends that the Mannings have never been damaged.
When do the Mannings claim they were first damaged?
The Mannings claim that they were first damage, at least the operative act that would have caused them damage, would have been the MERS assignment of the deed of trust into the ultimate beneficiary, the foreclosing
beneficiary.
That occurred
in 2012?
Either 2011 or 2012. The assignment certainly would have...
The complaint's filed 2015, so if the MERS assignment was in 2012, does that mean the Mannings are not claiming any damages until less than 4 years before they filed their complaint?
So the question here is what is really the nature of the claims? The nature of the claim is that MERS, in the sense of being named as a beneficiary, is in and of itself problematic under the CPA. Notwithstanding the rejection of that theory by the McAfee court and some of the other courts, that the role of MERS arises out of the deed of trust, whether or not there has been an assignment. So that if the existence of MERS is unfair, if it's deceptive, if it's causing them injury in terms of inquiry or whatever.
Haynes said naming MERS as a beneficiary is presumptively deceptive. And I'm exploring if we use the 12b-6 motion, we have to assume the facts in the complaint are true rather than looking at what the true facts are. And that's why I ask you when they claim to be damaged and what act they claim damaged them. And your answer was an act that occurred in 2012 is the act they claimed damaged them.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what they claim. The argument from the respondent's perspective is that the legal theory underlying that claim is really something that arose out of the existence of MERS and the deed of trust that is barred.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing our spirited arguments, I didn't fully answer your question, but I would like to defer that for a moment and just pick up where we start.
Well, let me ask you the same question. What, according to your client's complaint, what act do they claim caused them damage?
Well, for sure, when the trustee sale occurred and they lost over $300,000 of equity in a property that they could have marketed it within a reasonable period of time and saved their equity. That follows the
reasoning. The holding of the trustee sale is the deceptive act that caused them damage?
It was in bad faith. There was, under Clem, just like Clem, the little old lady.
Let me, before you go off down the Clem path, is there any other act of any defendant that your client's complaint alleges harmed your clients?
Yes. When MERS took the act, well, MERS, took the action suggesting that it had the authority to assign this deed of trust to Bank of New York Mellon as trustee for a securitized trust. Now, that happened in, I believe it was 2012. And that falls within the statute of limitations so that we can proceed under the 19.86 claim.
So the two wrongful acts are the assignment of the deed of trust in 2012 and the sale in 2015?
Well, there's more wrongful acts than that, and that's what distinguishes this from the Mary case.
Okay, what other wrongful acts are you, did your clients allege in the complaint caused harm?
When they failed to continue the trustee sale. If they would have just been reasonable with us instead of just rushing to judgment on this and taking all of my client's equity, we probably wouldn't even be here because there was an adequate sales opportunity for my client, which is not of record.
Was that pled in the complaint?
We did not plead. We want to sell the property.
If it's a 12B6 motion, I can only look at the allegations
exactly.
Of the complaint. I asked you what the standard of review was, and so we're looking at the complaint.
Yeah.
And I've now got three things that you've identified that you pled that caused your client's harm to support a CPA claim. Is there anything else?
I'm going to run out of time, and I apologize for not having on the tip of my tongue just exactly what the answer is. However, I would tell you this, that one of the harms is the conclusion by these defendants, apparently behind closed doors, that it was okay to move forward with the trustee's sale, that has been bad faith, according to Clem, based upon the value of the property and no opportunity to mitigate those losses. And secondly, I would suggest to you that the Mary case is a very narrow exception to the waiver issues where it must be waived. The statute, as you correctly point out, the Supreme Court focused on the word may. Now, the defense says, well, these are the only remedies available, and that would be the Consumer Protection Act and fraud. Not true. If, in fact, we did, in fact, reserve our right, and we specifically reserved our rights, even though we did not seek a TRO. The TRO is a single path.
What case supports your claim your clients can reserve their rights rather than using the TRO remedy of the Deeds of Trust Act?
The word may in the statute instead of the word shall. There's no mandatory duty to seek a TRO prior to the trustee's sale. None whatsoever. Of course, if it's just as the Mary case in Division 3 said, well, if it's just a little nitty-gritty dotted I or cross T that was failed, something that can be corrected without any prejudice, then you've waived. We'll presume that you've waived. But in this case, clearly the verified complaint says we're not waiving anything. And by the way, in the briefing that said, they asked for injunctive relief post-sale, and that's not a cause of action. No, it isn't. It's a remedy. But if you look at the theories of the case portion of the complaint, it says theories of recovery and remedies. And we put them on notice. If you do a trustee sale on this, based on the facts of this case, we reserve the right to seek post-sale equitable.
So are you arguing then that notwithstanding Klein versus Lackey, that you don't have to bring a motion for a TRO to restrain the sale in order to retain the equitable right?
Exactly right. There's nothing
Klein
in
Klein doesn't hold that, you don't think?
I understand that, but, you know.
You understand what? I mean, Klein is a pretty solid precedent.
It's a precedent.
But you don't think it applies to your
Well,
case.
In Klein, there was no reservation like this. There was no specific putting everybody on notice. We're not going to get seek a TRO pre-sale. There's lots of equity in this property, and we want you to work with us. Remember, the trustee.
That would pretty much eviscerate Klein if that were the law, wouldn't it? Because that's what everybody would do. They would just say, well, we're not going to bring a TRO. We're going to reserve our rights.
Well, they're going to have to do it in good faith. And they're going to have facts that will fit that role, which this one does.
How does that further the goal of a quick and expeditious way to deal with these matters, which is one of the three goals the Supreme Court's
It harmonizes what the Supreme Court has said in protection of homeowners, because the Deeds of Trust Act will be construed strictly in favor of the homeowners.
Thank you.
Thank you for hearing us.